On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Linda Douglas in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In the news this week, fireworks of all kinds, a shocking diagnosis of who's behind London and Glasgow bomb plots.
Two young doctors from Jordan and Iraq are now believed to have been the key players in this plot, a terror cell comprised of at least five doctors.
No jail time for Scooter Libby. Joe Wilson charges cover-up.
This was not a commutation, just a Scooter Libby sentence. This was a cover-up of the cloud over the vice president's office.
Bill Clinton stumps for Hillary in Iowa.
Please welcome our friend, President Bill Clinton.
Thank you.
We have a great panel to help us make sense of it all today. Just back from the campaign trail in Iowa, Ann Kornblue, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Also in Washington, Ken Walsh, chief White House correspondent and the senior editor at U.S. News and World Report. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. And welcome to all of you. And I would like to start, if I could, with you, Ken Walsh, on the subject of Scooter Libby's pardon by President Bush. Will it help him or hurt him?
Well, I think that the whole pardon issue has now become so wrapped up in complication and sort of charging and countercharging that I think what ends up happening here is that the public thinks it's sort of another case of Washington figures protecting their own, sort of the elites taking care of their cronies and their buddies. And the more people talk about the comparisons to what President Clinton did at the end of his administration and pardons and other presidents, I think the impression people have is that once these people get into power in Washington, there's really not a lot of difference in how they handle protecting their friends. And I think there's a good case to be made that that's exactly what happens here. I mean, we could go into the details on Libby, but basically what the president did is he allowed the felony conviction to stand for lying, in essence, lying to FBI agents and a grand jury about Libby's role in a White House leak of the identity of this covert CIA official, Valerie Plame. But President Bush kept Libby from going to jail. The sentence involved $250,000 in a fine, which Libby has now paid, but Bush granted a commutation of the jail time, so Libby doesn't have to spend any time in the Huskow.
And I just want to correct when you say commutation, something where I misspoke earlier. You are absolutely correct. The president commuted his sentence. He did not pardon Scooter Libby. He has said that that's not off the table, but he did. Right. He commuted his sentence. Let's listen to what the president said this week, because when he made the decision to commute this sentence, because much has been made of the fact that this was a decision that the president made pretty much on his own. Let's listen to what the president said.
First of all, I had to make a very difficult decision. I weighed this decision carefully. I thought that the jury verdict should stand. I felt the punishment was severe. So I made a decision that would commute his sentence, but leave in place a serious fine and probation. As to the future, I'm, rule nothing in and nothing out.
So that was the president saying that what he made was a decision that he will take responsibility for, and it prompted an immediate reaction, certainly from partisan circles, but also from Joe Wilson, who was the former ambassador and the husband of Valerie Plame, the CIA agent whose name was leaked and revealed as she was a covert agent, was at the center of this entire controversy. Let's listen to how Wilson reacted to the president's decision to commute Libby's sentence.
The fact that the president short-circuited our system of justice by giving Scooter Libby a get-out-of-jail-free card, thereby eliminating any incentive that he would tell the truth to the prosecutor, guarantees that there is a cloud of suspicion put over the office of the president and makes him potentially a suspect in an ongoing obstruction of justice case.
Ann Kornblue, let's go to you now and talk about some of the reactions. Certainly in Congress, I understand that you've been out on the campaign trail and you've been listening to what the candidates have been saying, and we'll ask you about that in a few moments. But in Congress now, there's going to be yet another effort to investigate the president, investigate the White House, see if there was something untoward done here, that the administration abused its power, as Democrats have been charging on many fronts. Does this, after a while, become white noise in the political arena, Anne?
Well, I think that's actually a really interesting question for the Democrats to consider at this point. I think, as we saw this week, at first blush, it was a good issue for the Democrats. We saw them jump on it, obviously attack President Bush. But taking a step back, this is actually quite consistent with the Bush we have come to know, for better or for worse. He's been very loyal to the people who are close to him. There is a reason that Alberto Gonzalez survived a lot of the earlier attacks on him. And I think for Republicans and for some of the base that Bush has lost support from recently, this might actually redound to his benefit. But on the other hand, for Democrats, it gave them an early opening. I think the question you ask, though, is a good one. The Congress's approval ratings so far are terrible, almost as bad as the president's himself. And as we saw in the late 1990s, when Republicans pursued the Clintons during impeachment, and they lost seats, I think the Democrats risk looking as though they are simply on the attack, and they aren't managing to actually achieve anything as they promised to do. So I would expect to see, when they return this next week, when they come back from the July 4th recess, we're going to see the Senate talking again about Iraq, and we're going to see the House taking up its business again. And I think we're going to see some effort. I've been led to believe we're going to see some effort by the leaders too, although some of the committee members are going to want to pursue this, also try and do things that look forward-looking as opposed to just going after the president.
Jack Beatty, let's bring you into this discussion. There's been a lot of talk, certainly, by people who look at the legal precedents that may or may not be set. Now, what a president does isn't necessarily legally binding in terms of setting precedents in a court of law, but there's been a lot of interest in the legal community about the president's decision to challenge the federal sentencing laws in this one case. After all, Libby was sentenced to a 30-year sentence, not a 30-month sentence, that is, not unusual in a federal perjury case such as this one. The administration and the Justice Department have been very strong in defending the federal sentencing guidelines. They haven't sought any leniency or been sympathetic to arguments for leniency. What about the president's decision here in this specific case to do something that his own Justice Department might not have approved of?
Yes, we find it hypocritical. You know, if we dial this thing back, I think a pattern stands out. And the pattern is that that cloud that Patrick Fitzgerald said had formed over the vice president's office is now permanently over George W. Bush's reputation. In January and February, the Libby defense was saying, we're going to, you know, our guy was a fall guy. We're going to point that out. We're going to call witnesses from the administration. We're going to, you know, they're trying to pin the rap on him. And then suddenly that disappeared. Suddenly that defense disappeared. And Libby did not testify in his own trial, almost sort of punting. Well, why? Well, now we know within, you know, weeks of his going to jail, he receives this commutation. I mean, the pattern suggests a direct cover up from the top. It's just too striking. Why did that defense just change on the dime? And why, just as Bush and Bush didn't pardon him, which goes a step, it was aimed particularly at the sentence. And my guess is that the Libby defense people were saying, look, the time's running out, he's gonna talk, you people have got to act. And I think they acted. And, you know, Bush's reputation has been with President Grant and with Buchanan as one of the great bunglers and incompetents in American history. But now this puts him over on the Nixon side as well. And I think we're going to hear a lot about this for a long time.
Ken Walsh, you certainly are familiar with President Bush's actions and thinking and way of dealing with things. What is the likelihood here that he will take the next step and pardon Scooter Libby? After all, he did say that the jury's verdict should stand at least for now.
Well, you know, as we were saying earlier, Bush is does prize loyalty almost above anything else. So I would think that the idea of a pardon is quite likely. But I think that this is in many ways a very clever political gambit on his part, if you just look at it from the political side of things, because now there's no incentive, of course, for Libby to talk to the prosecutors further. And he also has no, he can always say, if Congress wants him to testify, he has a pending appeal of his actual conviction. So he can say, I can't testify because I'm in the middle of the judicial system. And so it's actually cleverly designed to keep more information from coming out about exactly what happened and what people are calling cover-ups or the role of the vice president and the attempts to discredit critics and to stifle dissent. That whole discussion has now been basically stonewalled. And so if you look at it as a political calculation, it was actually quite a clever move for President Bush to do this. And then in the end, he can pardon Libby at the very end of his presidency, which is the presidential pattern for many of Bush's predecessors.
Let's talk about how the Clintons, who were out on the campaign trail, weighed in on the subject. But first, let's hear a little bit about from Bill Clinton, who was campaigning for his wife in Iowa.
I was denied the opportunity to participate in this vigorous thing you call the caucus because Tom Harkin also ran for president that year. I don't know that I understand it entirely, but one thing I do know is you don't get any votes no matter how well you're doing in the polls unless somebody shows up, hangs around, and hangs in there for you. So what I'm here to do is to ask you to do that for Hillary.
That was former President Bill Clinton campaigning for his wife in Iowa. And one of the things that happened, Ann Kornbluh, during that campaign visit was that Hillary Clinton began to speak out in very strong, critical terms about the commutation of Scooter Libby's sentence, which is interesting because earlier, a couple of weeks ago, when she was pressed on this subject by Chris Matthews of Hardball, she refused to weigh in. She said, I don't think you need my opinion on this. She laughed. She shied away from it. Finally, some of her supporters in the crowd began to boo Matthews, who pressed the question of what she thought. What's changed here, and what is she saying?
That's right. It's a really interesting shift. What she said, and she said it only at one event on the campaign trail this week on Tuesday night, directly after the news had come out about the Bush decision on Libby. She criticized it as part of a culture of, and I'm going to get the exact phrasing wrong here, but it's a phrase that she uses often, which is that it's part of a culture of corruption, cronyism, and incompetence. She got a huge response from the crowd in Iowa, and obviously it was a calculated risk for her because later that night and the next day, all of the reporters traveling with her and on the ground in Iowa, of course, raised the obvious question, which was, how is this any different than the last-minute pardons, many of them, that her husband had given out at the end of his term to great controversy, in particular, the pardon he granted to the financier Mark Rich, whose wife had given lots of money to Democrats. It was a huge controversy, even criticized by some Democrats at the end of the second Clinton term. But it was clear from the way the Clinton campaign responded that they had decided that this was really worth, it was a calculated risk, and it was worth it for them to appeal to the crowd, who was very fired up. She at one point asked, did you hear the news today? And everybody responded. So it was clear that among activists, this had really hit a chord. And then after that, she let it go, and she went back to her regular stump speech for the two remaining days. In their view, she is still working to shore up that base in Iowa. She has been battling now with Barack Obama for a full 6 months for that core Democratic support. And to not mention the pardon would have raised, I think, almost as many questions. I certainly heard from some Clinton advisors that there was nothing. It was sort of a no-win situation. They couldn't not raise the question. So they did. She said it once, it was in very strong terms, and then she let it go.
And this is, of course, as you say, always been a festering issue that has been lurking out there for Hillary Clinton because the pardon of Mark Rich was so controversial. There were some I think it was 141 pardons, something like that, that President Clinton issued at the last moment. Her brothers, Tony and Hugh, were involved in seeking pardons for, in the case of Hugh, the one brother, for money. In the case of
That's
Tony,
correct.
The other brother, for somebody for whom he worked. And so Tony Snow, the president's spokesperson, President Bush's spokesperson, said, "I don't know what Arkansan is for chutzpah, but this is a giant case of it." So the Bush administration, one can imagine, is hoping that they can turn this around on the Clintons. And before we ask any more questions about that, let's bring in some of our callers. We have several people who have some thoughts about this. Bob is on the line from Boston, Massachusetts. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and a question. My comment is the Bush administration, will probably go down as the worst in history. And I think as far as the Scooter Libby businesses goes, it's part of the pattern. And I'm not really surprised about that. My question would be, I guess, going forward, investigating these types of corruption situations, which have become, just so common, especially in this administration, how do we do that without those becoming, quote unquote, white noise, or I don't know. I guess I just wonder how we can go forward with that. That's my question.
Well, I think that is a very good question. Ken Walsh, do you want to tackle that one?
Sure. Well, I think that, we were talking earlier about how the Democrats could go too far in these investigations, but what Ann was just saying, I think, shows the other side of that. The liberal base of the Democratic Party is absolutely detesting President Bush and this administration, and they want as many investigations as possible. They want the candidates for president to speak out as forcefully as possible against the president on not only just the Libby issue, but on much wider issues, the war in Iraq and the whole policies domestic of the administration and so on. So while maybe independents and certainly conservatives will be upset with the investigations, and there are many, many going on in oversight hearings and so on, and I might add that the Republicans sort of neglected this whole oversight role when they were in control. So I think that that's another whole issue. But basically, I think that while independents may think that perhaps the investigations may go too far, the Democratic activist core is very eager and on the march to push the president to block policies, investigate the administration. They felt he's gotten away with all kinds of things over the last 7 years or so. And I think that this is the tightrope that these candidates are walking. But as Hillary Clinton did in Iowa, obviously, she can't, in Iowa particularly, where the activists are very active in liberal causes and are left of center in many ways, she can't ignore these issues, even though perhaps independents may think that they're going too far. So I think mm-hmm. that's the tightrope.
Well, and Linda, I would add that Hillary Clinton has a new line, or a new to me line in her some speech now, where she talks about the fact that she's a woman who's running, and isn't that convenient because there's a need for a lot of cleaning up in the next administration. So as a woman, she's uniquely suited to come in and clean out all the corruption that has been there. And the line, I would say, somewhat to my surprise, got a huge reaction from the crowd in Iowa as well.
Well, there is so much to say about this, but we should move on now, because you have just gotten off the bus, and you've all got thoughts about what's going on the campaign trail, and I certainly want to bring Jack into this as well. But let's go back to you, if we can, for just a moment, Ann, because you did see former President Clinton campaigning for his wife. Was that
That's
a good
correct.
Thing or a bad thing for her, do you think?
Well, I think that's going to be the enduring question for the weeks to come. He's going to repeat the move again next week. He's going to travel with her to New Hampshire. So they obviously think so far it's a good thing. He didn't steal the show. He is still former President Clinton. He is incredibly charismatic. The crowds, a lot of the people I spoke to in the crowds in Iowa came out, they said, to see him as much as to see her. I found even a couple of Barack Obama supporters who nonetheless were curious and came to see the former president. It does, however, raise all sorts of questions about her running on her own merits, about, I think more importantly, whether it's a backward-looking campaign. The argument, the chief argument that they made during the trip was, we might be yesterday's news, but wasn't yesterday's news pretty good? And the message of why don't we return to the 1990s or at least start the 21st century over again is really in direct contrast to what we're hearing from Barack Obama, who's saying, let's move past all of that and actually look forward.
And that so each of them, in other words, is trying to represent herself and himself as the agent of change in a very different way. Let's switch over, if we can, for just a moment to the Republican field, because I know, Jack, that you got some thoughts about John McCain. And John McCain had a very bad week financially. He's running out of money. He is laying off staff. He appears to be in trouble. He's shutting down campaign offices. And yet he fights on. He went to Iraq. He went to Baghdad to speak to the soldiers and to reiterate the position that has made him so controversial with many, and that is his strong, strong support for continuing the surge in Iraq.
The war in which you have fought has divided the American people, but it has divided no American in their admiration for you. We all honor you. We are all, those who supported the decision that placed you in harm's way and those who opposed it.
So, Jack Beatty, what do you think here is the future of John McCain, who is principled, certainly one can say, in supporting the war, but it doesn't get him many votes with independents, who's made the Republicans in his party very angry about his stand on immigration? What happens to him here, do you think?
Well, people are saying it's very bad for him. I don't think there's any question about it. He's a conviction politician, and his convictions are now in conflict with what many Republicans want. I mean, the immigration debate was, I think, really fatal for him. It was called by his opponents the McCain-Kennedy bill. And, of course, he and Kennedy had worked on that earlier versions of that bill. And that the so-called amnesty in that bill, which he, I think, and I think McCain rightly said, to do nothing is to have silent amnesty. Nevertheless, that didn't gain any traction with the Republican base. And I'm looking at a poll now of Republican views, and the war in Iraq is first, terrorism second, and then a very close third at 19% illegal immigration. Well, McCain is, Republicans just on prudential grounds could feel that he's wrong on the war in Iraq, in that if he's the nominee, that the issue will be even more salient because of his, passionate support of the surge in the war. And then the problem with the base, the 19% illegal immigration. So he's it's all come wrong for him, it seems to me, in this cycle, and he may well be an also-ran, within a few months.
And Ken Walsh, one can only speculate here that McCain's troubles are symptomatic of system-wide troubles in the Republican field, certainly. The Republican candidates are not raising as much money as the Democrats to add to their troubles. They're spending at a faster rate than the Democrats are. They are searching for some kind of white knight to pull them out of their trouble. You've watched Fred Thompson, who is supposed to be the one who might be able to ride in on the white horse and pull them out of their trouble. Is that going to happen, do you think? Is he the solution to what appears to be a problem?
Well, I think he is going to run, and will probably announce within 2 weeks. I think it's interesting, the clip you played of McCain. You just did get a sense there of what so many Republicans talk about McCain now, that sort of a downer. I mean, it just sort of, he seems sort of weary. He just seems like he's not the old optimistic, joyous John McCain that people remember from 2000. But that's a feeling that permeates the Republican Party. And they're just very depressed in many ways and demoralized by not only President Bush's problems, but this fundraising gap and the sense that the issues are going in another direction from the Republican Party and so on. But I happened to have interviewed Mitt Romney a week ago, and the contrast there is very dramatic, because he's trying to bill himself as more of this sort of Reagan-style optimist. And there is an undercurrent there, of course, of difficulty in that the party is behind in a lot of ways, generically with the Democrats in some polls and so on. But you have somebody like Romney and Fred Thompson, who will now try to sort of do a three-cushion shot and be more in the optimistic mold, the upbeat mold. And that's part of what I think Thompson's appeal would be if he got into this, sort of the late arriver, the guy who's not part of these partisan debates, although he was in the Senate from Tennessee for 8 to 10 years, but he's trying to build himself as the outsider, the fresh face, and the TV star and the movie star, which is, again, that Reagan comparison. But I do think that Thompson is serious. I had some doubt about that some weeks ago, but I have been persuaded that he's very serious. He's assembling a team, and I think by the end of July, you're going to see that other face and that famous voice of Fred Thompson in this race.
And let me go back to you now for a moment to talk back about the Democrats. You have been watching Barack Obama on the campaign trail. Many things have been going on under the radar with Obama. He's talking about a lot of things that aren't necessarily getting into the national media, drawing still the big crowds, drawing the enormous sums of money from huge numbers of donors. And yet, for some reason, he still doesn't seem to move up much against Hillary Clinton in the polls. Why is that, and what is he saying out there?
It's a really fascinating question. The Democratic field, unlike the Republican field that we were just talking about, has been incredibly static. Hillary Clinton has been and remains the front runner at the national level. Obama has been, since he first got in a second place, but a very distinct second place, as much as two digits behind her. And then John Edwards has been in third, and it has not moved really at all. There are a couple of factors going on here. One is simple name recognition. Another is that Hillary Clinton has really locked down support from not only women, but also women in a specific category, women who are somewhat downscale and less educated. And those women are not up for grabs any longer. So Obama is looking around the edges of the Democratic field. He appeals more to independents. I would also note, though, that these are national polls. And what's really important at this juncture is to look at the Iowa polls and the New Hampshire polls. The same happens to be true in Iowa, that Hillary is that Edwards has been ahead and that Obama has not gone into first place. But it's a little closer in Iowa, and it's a little bit more fluid. So what all of the campaigns would say at this point is that it's early. In terms of what he's talking about on the campaign trail, his message has been quite consistent. He talks about optimism, hope, forward-lookingness, and also trying to have a different kind of government and a different kind of campaign. And his message is really, we can't have the lobbyists running the country anymore. We can't have large donors running the parties anymore.
We're talking about a week in the news under the big headlines. Here's a sampling of other stories making news this week. BBC reporter Alan Johnston was freed after 114 days in captivity.
It is the most extraordinary 4th of July for me that I could imagine.
Russia strikes gold and lands the 2014 Winter Olympic Games.
The 22nd Olympic Winter Games in 2014 are awarded to the city of Sochi. Yeah!
And on a sad note, opera singer Beverly Sills succumbs to lung cancer. My guests again this hour are Anne Kornblue, she's the national correspondent for The Washington Post, Ken Walsh, chief White House correspondent and senior editor at U.S. News and World Report, and Jack Beatty, on-point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly magazine. And Jack, let me ask you, I just want to finish up here with the presidential campaign because there's just so much happening out there right now. John Edwards, once again, got himself into a little hot water with a story that was at the hands of his hairdresser in yesterday's Washington Post. This hairdresser says that actually one of his haircuts, when you counted the travel time, was $1,250. Does this hurt Edwards, or has he managed to bat this stuff away?
Oh, I don't know. I think that reporter, John Solomon, late of the Associated Press, I mean, I think if we're going to be candid here, it's been known for a long time that he that he runs Republican talking points. His reporting, the Post has had to apologize for things he's done in the past. And, you know, there's no new story here. This hairdresser has been on, has been quoted, in fact, in an AP story some months ago coming out with some of this stuff. This is just mischief, I think, and very shabby of the Washington Post to put that kind of thing on the cover. But to get back to Obama, you know, it's a little bit like he seems to be sort of a Gene McCarthy Democrat. He's appealing to upscale Democrats, and this isn't going to help him in the long run. His ad, the one ad I've seen, shows Lawrence Tribe, the Harvard law professor, saying, "Oh, he's brilliant. And he could have earned lots of money, but instead he decided to serve the poor and enter." You know, who is that? You know, who's the target of that ad? Lawrence Tribe saying he's brilliant and he could have made much more money. I mean, that's almost makes him seem like a Lady Bountiful or something who passed up all these riches so that he could help the downtrodden. It doesn't help at all with the problem that Ann is just talking about, which is, less affluent voters are rallying to Hillary Clinton, and at least women. And so I think this whole imagery of him as the brilliant young man is not going to help him.
Interesting point. Let's hear from Dan now, who's calling in from Des Moines, Iowa. Dan, go ahead.
Hi, Linda.
Good morning.
I live in Iowa, and basically, if you want to see a political candidate, you have ample opportunities if you live here. And there's an interesting dynamic here. You know, the national polls basically show a Hillary Obama race, but in Iowa, most people I talk to, like John Edwards, and, you know, we expect in Iowa for him to do really well here. So I think you have to take these national polls with a grain of salt. You know, there's going to be the national polls before the Iowa caucus, and there's going to be the national polls after the Iowa caucus, and I think a lot is going to change on that night, especially if John Edwards does win in Iowa.
Okay, well, John Edwards clearly is doing well in Iowa and has the devoted support of many out there, and his fundraising numbers, which are not as strong as Hillary Clinton's and Barack Obama's, don't seem to be making a difference to those who are supporting him with great passion. Let's change subjects here if we can, because we still have a lot to talk about here. This was not a good week for President Bush politically, because once again, as he fights to build support, continuing support for the surge in Iraq, support that is obviously waning by the day, he lost another key Republican Senator, Pete Domenici of New Mexico, who finally joined the ranks of those who want to bring the troops home by the spring.
I am unwilling to continue our current strategy when the Iraqi government fails to advance the interests of the Iraqi people on even make modest progress towards self-sufficiency.
Ken Walsh, Pete Domenici has been a loyal supporter of President Bush's throughout, as was Richard Lugar of Indiana, a modest man, a knowledgeable man in foreign affairs, and George Voinovich of Ohio. Susan Collins of Maine has been another who's been very critical. Is this beginning to build to a point where the president might actually have to reassess his position and do something different?
Well, in many ways, this Domenici story is actually the most important Bush story of the week, more important than the whole Libby issue, which has gotten so much attention. Because, as you say, you've had Richard Lugar, the very well-respected ranking Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Ohio's George Voinovich also breaking with the president, and now Domenici, who has been very much a stalwart. And the backstory of this is, it's interesting that what apparently pushed Domenici in this direction was feedback from families of troops who have been killed in Iraq, who were saying, "We really need you to do something to start bringing the troops home." And when that kind of thing happens to a senator or a legislator, or really anybody in public life, that's a very moving thing. And I suspect that Domenici, that's only the tip of the iceberg. We're just hearing a little bit of this. But for somebody like Domenici, a conservative who supported the war, to do this, I think it is a big story. And it is, I think, causing a lot of angst in the White House, that they were hoping that this series of reports in September would sort of be a stopper, that the Republicans, at least, would hold off in criticizing the Iraq policy and the so-called surge of troops until General Petraeus and these and the commander in the region and other reports are issued. That's not happening. Republicans are now moving to have a policy change, not a quick withdrawal, as Senator Domenici said, but moving toward a withdrawal, and disengagement is sort of the word. And there are a number of proposals in the Senate that would move that way back toward what the Iraq Study Group suggested some months ago that the president didn't accept initially. So I think there is a big change happening here, much faster than the White House wanted in pushing for disengagement. Whether the president will remain where he is now and sort of the stay the course, although he doesn't like to use that phrase anymore, that's what it amounts to, we don't know. But certainly the pressure is building in his core now to make some change in Iraq.
It's such an interesting political dynamic because, as you say, these senators are hearing from their constituents. Senator Collins, whom I just mentioned, goes out to Walter Reed, the hospital for the injured soldiers, and sees her wounded constituents at home and talks very movingly about how that's affected her thinking. And there is pressure building, though maybe not enough just yet, to finally change the strategy in the Congress among Republicans, and certainly Democrats are there. But on the campaign trail, Anne, with the Republican candidates, that's not the case. They are, for the most part, embracing a continually muscular policy in Iraq. Why is that, do you think?
Well, there are two separate campaign trails, I would say. The Republicans in the Congress that we're discussing, and including Senator Domenici, are the one thing they have in common is they're all up for re-election this next cycle. And that is why their constituents' views have begun to matter so much. And it's really it's sort of a signal of democracy in action. On the Republican presidential field, there's not too much difference between the candidates, with the exception of John McCain. And so it's similar in some respects to the Democratic side, where they are talking to the other party rather than to each other. Republicans have decided, by and large, Romney and Giuliani and even McCain, decided by and large, they support the war, they support the president, we want to beat the terrorists, and that's the end of it. On the Democratic side, we want to get out. This war is not a success. That's the end of it. So I think as the nominating processes move forward, you may begin to see them go after each other at the margins of this issue. But so for now, they are all fundamentally in agreement with each other.
And Jack Beatty, let's bring you into this, because there does appear to be a stronger pro-war voice, certainly among the Republican candidates. There is a fear among Democrats that this works somehow, that in the end, in spite of the fact that the Democratic candidates seem to be more popular with their constituents, at least at the moment, in spite of the fact that the Democratic candidates are raising more money, in spite of the fact that the polls show that the country is opposed to the war, that a message like Giuliani's, we will bar the doors against all terrorists and be as tough on the world as we can be, would be the one that will out. What about that?
Well, of course, he's conflating the war on terror with the war in Iraq. And, of course, the other argument is a substantial one, that, in fact, the war in Iraq is impeding the war on terror. We've even had reports, government reports, arguing as much from the intelligence services. And he's even said now in a debate that if we had it to do all over again, would he, knowing what he knows now, would he go into Iraq? He said, absolutely. Well, that's quite a statement. And it's just hard to believe I understand that he will try to do it, but I can see that as if he gets to the general election, that I don't think is, I think it's going to be extremely hard to sell that. I mean, the public is way ahead of the congressman now. General William Odom made a statement the other day saying just that, how far ahead the public is. And he says, you know, the Congress has the power to cut off funds, and it should do that. And he argues that is what's supporting the troops. And obviously it is. It means saving their lives. And then he says, General Odom does, if the president will not then go along with that, the president should be impeached. And I thought, well, yes, those are the powers of Congress over the executive. And a lot of this stuff about setting deadlines and dates and so on, it's all sort of kicking the can down the road to the end of the Bush administration. And I'm terribly afraid that there's going to be a kind of consensus that we need to keep, oh, I don't know, 60,000 troops there, indefinitely, and that will be the new compromise. And, of course, they're going to die just as much, and the Iraqi government is going to continue to act irresponsibly.
Well, and of course, those who do point to the war on terror as being part of the overall war against the war in Iraq and other parts of the world point to what happened this week in London, where there was the foiled bombing attempt at the hands of all people, some doctors. Let's hear what the very new Prime Minister of London had to say in reaction to that.
I've asked Lord West, the new terrorism minister, to conduct an immediate review as to what arrangements we must make in relation to recruitment to the NHS because of what we know has happened over the last few days.
That's Prime Minister Gordon Brown with a terrible gift put on his doorstep as soon as he stepped into the office here. And Ken Walsh, let me ask you, how does this play at home? We want to talk about the doctor angle of this, certainly, but how does this play here in the United States, in your view?
Well, I think it is a very chilling story in that, you know, a lot of Americans feel that the terrorists are perhaps sort of furious poor people who are kept out of prosperity, and they feel resentment toward the West, and they resent the United States, and there's a whole series of reasons having to do with their life circumstances. But to have physicians, you know, we're brought up to think that the healing arts are sort of the top of everybody's list of admirable jobs, and to have physicians involved in acts of terrorism like this, I think is quite a shocking thing. And I think that it plays into this idea of I happen to be working on a piece for U.S. News about the sort of the wild cards in the campaigns, and this is one of them, another terrorist attack. And this idea of keeping us safe has been, I think, brought back up again, and that's partly, I think, why you see where Giuliani's support is coming from, the idea that he's the mayor who knows how to do this. Whether that's right or not, I'll leave to the listeners to judge, but basically that's the core of his appeal. He'll keep us safe, and he talks about that all the time. And when you have an incident like this in the U.K., people wonder, I think, well, you know, are these people all over the place? And you get this sense of fear. And I think that plays into the idea of keeping us safe. And the Republicans do have an advantage on that. If you look at the polling data, you know, a lot of people in the United States now have separated Iraq from the perception of the war on terrorism. Mm-hmm. In other words, Iraq is different from the war on terrorism. And as Jack said, that we can't confuse these because one might be hindering the other. But basically, an incident like the UK brings back this whole idea of security and safety, and I think that helps the Republicans.
It raises another issue too, Anne, and that is the issue of the doctors who were involved here. I'm wondering if this will have any impact in terms of the efforts in the immigration bill to award extra points to people who are coming over from foreign countries to be skilled professionals, such as doctors. Will this increase suspicion of foreigners, and will it make it more difficult now for foreign doctors to come to the United States, do you think?
Well, it's certainly an interesting twist coming on the heels of this immigration debate. One of the arguments by the critics of the new legislation was that we need to crack down on the borders, we need to tighten up the borders for fear of a terrorist coming across the borders and setting off an explosion that way. These were obviously not terrorists swimming across the English Channel. They were there legally. As we said, they're highly educated. And it's hard to imagine what kind of constriction you could put into law regarding doctors as opposed to any other kind of educated person who's applying for a visa for permanent residence here. All that said, the immigration debate is, for all intents and purposes, dead. This bill's not coming back this year. It's yet another. We've been listing the disasters for the Bush administration recently, and it's right up there with all the others we've mentioned. So while I would expect it to be used in the context of campaign speeches and discussions about immigration and how we approach it, there's going to be, as far as we can tell, no practical effect in Congress this year.
And Jack, finally, to wrap up here, if you can, in about 30 seconds, will this affect the debate over domestic wiretapping? Will there be a push now to begin to find these sleeper cells in the United States?
I hope not. I don't think there are any. And if there are, they're not consequential. So I'm not... All I can say is I hope it doesn't.
Well, thank you very much to all of you. My guests again were Ann Kornbluh, the national correspondent for the Washington Post, national political correspondent, Ken Walsh, chief White House correspondent and senior editor at U.S. News and World Report, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. I am Linda Douglas, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.